Good morning. You're seeing the ads, but how effective are they in making the case for candidates? Political analyst Neil Milner has the long view, and today it's closing time for Celebration 2014. We're back and waiting to hear from you this hour in support of your public radio station. On Wednesday, October 15th, it's The Conversation.
And no matter what else you do, if you're really a playwright, you have your chance to prove it. Playbuilders Theater Company is looking for submissions, and founder Terry Madden has details. And while some artists work in words, wood, stone, and bronze, call to sculptor Steve Turnbull, and we'll talk to him as well.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
The Conversation starts now. Next, this news. And hope that's starting your 8 o'clock hour on a nice note. Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. You're listening to The Conversation. Good morning, Chris Vanderkirk.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Here we are, and we're back at it again with closing time, and we hope that we're going to be up and running and having a regular show for you sometime very soon. But today, of course, we'll be having a couple of pledge breaks, and we hope that you're going to use them and call a friend and ask them to use them, too, and call
exactly.
us.
Exactly, and we're optimistic.
Very optimistic, but, you know, that can only carry us so far. We'll see how it actually turns out in reality. That part's up to you, but it's getting very exciting. Now, also getting very exciting, if you're paying attention, and I know you are, well, we are 3 weeks away from a general election. And there are lots of political ads all over the place, and they usually have two objectives: demobilize your opponent's voters and mobilize yours. Some are nice, character portraits. Others are blatant attacks. Political analyst Neil Milner says there's nothing wrong with attack ads. Criticism is an important way to learn. But the more relevant issue is whether the ad, positive or negative, is truthful. Neil Milner joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Since we last talked, we've seen this sort of, you know, quiet time after the primary ramp up, albeit slowly. I mean, it's not the same situation we've seen with other election campaigns. Still, it seems to be, you know, kind of on the I won't say sedate side, but quieter. But we are seeing attack ads now show up.
Yes, you've seen them recently, and there's been a few more. They tend to be sponsored by PACs, that is, not directly by the candidate themselves, which means the candidate is technically
out of the loop.
You've seen them both in the governor's race mainly, and you've seen them from both sides, both the people supporting Iona and the people supporting Ige.
But in 30 seconds, really, truly, there's only so much that can be said. And your whole point is, how do we find out what is really truthful? It means you can't just watch an ad.
Well, you don't really. I mean, I don't know how people expect to find a lot of detail from a 30-second ad, whether it's an attack ad or not attack ad. The communication process, political communication process in advertising, is an art. It's the same kind of art that you use to advertise products, which means that you're not going to learn policy details in 30 seconds. There's a new ad where Charles Zhu, I saw it last night, it's about him lowering the cost of living in Hawaii. Well, they make the claim, but they don't say how they're going to do it. Of course they don't say how they're going to do it. It's in 30 seconds. So when people complain about the vacuousness of the ads, what they're really doing is asking for more of the ads than you can possibly give. You're not going to learn policies from those ads. We can talk more about attack ads in a minute, but I think people have peculiar standards for what's supposed to happen in the ads. One of the reasons that ads get run over and over is that our memories are very fleeting in regard to what an ad says, even if it's a simple message or an indirect message.
And marketers know this.
Marketers know this.
You've got to see it, you know, 6-8 times before it sticks.
Yes, that's right. Marketers know it. Communication theorists know it. Everybody who's in the business of trying to communicate to others, including, by the way we communicate to in everyday life.
So as we look at these ads and know that very clearly you're getting such a tiny piece of the story, though, is it enough for most people to move them to some sort of action to go and look at more? Or really are we talking about somebody saying, well, that sounds nice, and really treading on the likability factor?
Ads are almost never game changers. They're a small part of a larger campaign. So what an ad does has more to do with the rest of the campaign than anything else. Let's talk about what kind of ads seem to be successful or not. You hear the argument lots of times that negative ads don't work in Hawaii. Well, that's not true. First of all, the literature on whether negative ads work or not generally is mixed. It's all about it depends, and it's probably about it depends because it depends on the rest of the category.
Campaign, right?
Yeah, negative ads or attack ads or critical ads work to the extent that they fit into a more effective part of a political campaign. The PRP ads in the mayoral race against Ben Cayetano were successful not just as ads in themselves, and they were very controversial. They weren't successful just because the ads were there. They were successful because the campaign knew how to make them part of a ground game and knew how to use those ads as part of a more
general
strategy.
In other words, all the pieces fit together.
All the pieces fit together.
Nothing was out there just sort of sent out in space.
That's right. Yeah. But again, these are small pieces, and they're just fit into the rest of the mosaic.
So as you look at how well-crafted some of the campaigns are now, are these little 30-second shots that we're seeing showing up on TV and on screens of whatever nature fitting into an overall strategy?
Well, I think,
are they working?
I don't know if they're working. I mean, I guess the ultimate decision about whether they're
working
is who wins.
Well, we'll know in 2.5 weeks, right.
Then everything that the person does is good, who the winner does, and all of a sudden everything that the loser did was bad.
Right, but the collateral material that you're seeing, I mean, we're all getting all kinds of things and saying, okay, does this really fit with what we've seen before?
Let me talk
about, how does that fit?
Let me talk about the two ads that have been around for a while now as opposed to the two newer ones. One is the ad about, it's an anti-Iona ad about his position on abortion, and the other is the ad against Ige in regard to him being a spender. So let's take the Ige one very quickly first. The Ige one is basically trying to take the standard Republican trope of Democrats being liberals and being tax and spend, reinforcing that by associating him with Abercrombie, so that in a sense that's about a tax and spend thing. That's a standard message. It's part of any kind of Republican campaign. The challenge here is that Republicans they've got such a small amount. The Iona ad against Iona that says that he's against abortion and so on, like all of these other ads, it takes things out of context. But it's put Iona in a very interesting position. What it's done, really, I think, is try to establish Iona as being a real Republican. Understand, Democrats, most of whom, you know, most of the voters here are Democrats, you've got a real Republican here, a real conservative here, a real social conservative. Keep that in mind. One of the things that's happened as a result of that ad, I think, is that his religious positions have become more visible. Derek the Pledge has had two very interesting articles about it since that time. I'm not saying that Derek wrote those things. They're very good because of that. But it puts Iona into a dilemma that all Republicans face here.
So bottom line, and I'm going to give you 30 seconds, what do we do from this point forward as you're watching these ads? What's the question you think people should be asking themselves?
Well, people should be asking how truthful they are, I guess. People should be asking, how does it affect me? And I think another thing that they should be asking is, how does this seem to fit in to the general message that these folks are trying to get out? Keeping in mind that the Republicans have to dig deep into a Democratic electorate in order to pull some votes.
All right, we've got to wrap it up for the moment because we're going to send it over to Pledge Central in just a minute and see how we're doing over there. Thanks so much for joining
us. You're
welcome. I'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. Neil Milner is a political analyst and the contributing editor of our biweekly segment, The Long View, and we'll talk to him 2 weeks from today.
You're back with The Conversation on HPR2. Playwrights can make an entire imagined world come alive on the stage, and for the fledgling author, the opportunity to see that work performed is the best way to judge its value, gauging its impact upon an audience. The Playbuilders Theater Company has a history of finding and developing new local works, and it's looking for submissions to its fourth annual Festival of Original Plays. It's a chance for exciting new voices to be heard and their work produced on the Leeward College stage. Terry Madden is the founder and president of Playbuilders, and she's with us this morning. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning, Chris.
I would think that one of the exciting things about this would be not quite knowing what it was you were going to get.
That's right. We never know what we're going to get, and it's always delightful. To me, my favorite part of the whole process is the play reading process. To know how many people have to make that commitment to sit down and write a play sometimes can take months, sometimes can take years. Means you are very passionate about what you have to say. And so it's always interesting and meaningful to sit down and read the play before we make the final selections.
And yet I would think for a playwright, when you type the words "the end," it's not the end of creating the play, is it?
No. The audience, you need an audience. You need actors to read. You need directors to listen to the content and make suggestions. It's a living thing, unlike what you mentioned to me before we started talking. Once you write a novel, you might make some tweaks, but with a play, it can go through many transformations before it finally gets to the stage.
Well, when you write a novel, you can't dictate how long it's going to take the reader to get through it.
That's right.
Whereas a play, as a written work, has duration. And you get that whole thing of when it might drag, when it might speed up. And that's what you kind of need to get from performance, don't you think?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. This year, I don't know if we're trying something brand new, and that is we want to bring children into it. We had a teacher tell us recently that she had a student write a monologue, and it was all about bullying. And it really made us feel like, wow, let's give the kids a chance to say what they have to say. So we're inviting teachers to send in scripts. Maybe they want to use it as a teaching mechanism. It can be teacher-led, but the kids have to write it.
Yeah.
And so we're welcoming scripts for ages 12 to 18 this time.
And we're going to learn a lot about what kids are thinking about, aren't we?
That's right.
That's terrific.
Thank you. Yeah, we're excited about that.
So there's a real power to that moment when you realize that somebody is really telling the truth about their life, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
But translating that into, say, a fictional work, that's where a lot of craft comes in.
Right, and we're very fortunate that on this island we have Kumukuhua Theater, we have TAG, we have the university. They learn. My mentor was Dr. Dennis Carroll. I learned from him how to write plays. And there's a tremendous group of people that really devote themselves to writing plays. And we've been very fortunate that several of the plays that have been in our festivals in the past have been picked up. Jan McGrath's Outage was picked up by TAG. About a year ago, Nancy Moss's Will the Real Charlie Chan Please Stand Up was picked up at Kumu. Marion Lyman Mercero, her Eddie Wingo, has been done by Honolulu Theater for Youth. And just recently this summer, it was at the Hawaii Theater. So it makes us feel good to know that some of these words were never heard until our play reading festival.
And even for a first-time playwright, you can have the knowledge that if you've really got something to say and the craft to say it well, you can get heard, you can get produced.
Right.
Yeah?
In fact, this year, one of the she didn't win the festival this time. Actually, Kelsey K.A. Pu'aloa won this year. But one of the playwrights just had the right tone, the right thing that Play Builders was looking for our Waipahu project. And her name is Kirsten Trombetta, and she's actually a student at Leeward Community College. She's studying under the tutelage of a prize-winning playwright, Camille de Moville. But she is actually collaborating with community as we speak, collecting stories to write a play that we have commissioned her for. So it's an opportunity for theater companies to hear your work.
Sure.
And maybe if we don't necessarily need that particular play, we need your skills. So.
Well, for the person out there who has a play in a drawer that they never thought would go anywhere or is working on one, the details are your submissions are due middle of next month.
Right, November 15th. Get them in now. And we need them to email them to us. We don't accept hard copies, to playsubmissions@playbuilders.org.
And they need to be either a Hawaii resident or a Hawaii theme?
Yes.
Those are the criteria?
Yes. And we really are encouraging our Hawaii Ohana to send their scripts in. But if there is someone who used to live in Hawaii and they have scripts they would like to send, we would encourage that.
The idea is write about what you know, and what
That's
you know
right.
should be Hawaii in the case of this particular.
Right. And you can tell when you get a script from someone who's not really familiar with Hawaii.
We've all seen those. Terry, thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you so much for having me,
Chris.
Great to have
you.
Really appreciate it.
Terry Madden is founder and president of Playbuilders of Hawaii Theater Company, which is looking for submissions to its fourth annual Festival of Original Plays. And the deadline is November 15th. Those need to be emailed, and you can learn more about it at hpr2.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Supply, announcing Radiance Reflective Roof Shingles, solar reflective shingles designed and made for Hawaii to reflect the heat and help keep homes cool. Learn more at radianceroof.com. Support for today's programming comes from Maui Arts and Cultural Center, presenting Indian Ink Company's Guru of Chai, a romantic comedy illustrating the contradictions of modern India. 7:30 tonight in McCoy Studio Theater. MauiArts.org.
Unihoa, ulehua, unihau, ukaua, uahu, umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, uhangaiti.
Yesterday on the show, we talked about some of the invasive species threatening the remaining species of Hawaii tree snails. Today in our backyard quiz, we're looking at one of the first attempts at biological control of an invasive in Hawaii. The pest in question was a weevil of the South Pacific origin that attacked sugarcane and became a real threat to Hawaii's dominant industry as early as the 1860s. The search for natural enemies began when a representative of the Hawaiian Sugar Planters Experiment Station traveled to Southeast Asia in January of 1907. He found one of these little pest eaters on the island of Java. It was a parasitic taconid fly that could eat 25 to 90% of the weevil's grubs. The problem that scientists had to face was just importing the flies. Several attempts to ship them to Hawaii failed, but in 1910, a shipment survived. They were distributed to plantations around the territory, where they succeeded in halting the spread of the invasive weevil. For today's backyard quiz, we're looking for the name of that pest. Post it, if you know, on Twitter. Our handle is HI Conversation, and we'll be back with the correct answer next half hour.
And this is The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio.
HPD domestic violence policies may not be changing, but how they are enforced will. At least that's according to HPD's chief. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check of yesterday's Public Safety Committee hearing. He joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann, and happy day 11 of the pledge drive, I guess you would say.
Or we could say it's day one of closing time. That maybe there that sounds go. A little bit better and more palatable. But as we're talking about things that are more palatable to people's ears, at yesterday's hearing, there was a great deal of discussion about domestic violence policies within HPD. What seemed to emerge, though, is that the policies themselves are not going to be changing, but how they are going to be enforced will be increasingly scrutinized. Would that be accurate?
Well, I think one of the things that Nick Ruby's article conveyed is that a culture has to change, that there is a way of operating, a code of silence that exists within HPD, that if you see a colleague breaking protocol or doing wrongdoing, there can be a great reluctance to come forward. Everybody knows everybody. Everybody works together. There's a fear of being ostracized. So what Major Lester Height said, and he heads the Criminal Investigation Division, he said he wants it to make it easier for cops to come forward when they see one of their buddies doing the wrong thing, especially in domestic violence cases. So that's a big thing that HPD has to confront.
With an internal look at how they're doing what they're doing and what they expect from each other, also knowing the law and that the law applies to them too.
Absolutely. And one other thing that came out of it is they want to increase the amount of domestic violence training for officers and new recruits. It's only about an hour a year. They want to increase that to several hours. The hope there is that cops will be more sensitive going forward. But one of the things that Carol Fukunaga and Kimberly Pine, in particular, the council members said yesterday, is they wanted to know more about what evidence is needed for an arrest. As we know, Sergeant Darren Cachola is not being charged with a crime, although there is an administrative investigation going on into him and the officers who were responsible. Remember the activity at the Waipahu restaurant and so forth.
Right, and the idea that maybe they were, you know, play fighting is what it's going around now, but we really don't know a lot of the true story about that, do we?
Exactly, and the emphasis here is, you know, everything has to be for the victim. You really have to think of their needs first, even when an HBD colleague is involved. So that's something that Lester Height said. Louis Kealoha, again, the chief, once again, promised that there has to be more transparency going forward. He promised that he will work to improve the public image of the department and disclose more information to citizens.
And any discussion about who will be delivering that training or how soon we can expect it?
I think it's something that you will see coming quite soon, and Kealoha promised that he'd be getting back to us, keeping the media informed, and I can guarantee Civil Beat will be following this issue closely.
Which means that we'll get to have more conversations about it right here on The Conversation. Thanks, Chad.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair is political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
Support for today's programming comes from Ballet Hawaii, presenting Stars of American Ballet with principal dancers from the New York City Ballet, Saturday, October 25th at Hawaii Theater. BalletHawaii.org.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we told you about an invasive weevil that threatened Hawaii's sugar crop until a species of fly was imported to combat it. The fly was the tachinid, a bug that could eat 25 to 90% of the weevil's grubs. It was first found in Java, Indonesia, where it fed on a similar weevil. And Dr. F.A.G. Muir of the Hawaii Sugar Planters Experiment Station had worked for years to find a species that would feed on the pest that was costing plantations millions of dollars annually. After several failed attempts to import the tachinids, planters finally established a breeding colony. Flies were distributed throughout the territory. Today, we ask you to name the pest checked by the flies. The introduction of the biological invasive brought success in the battle against the sugarcane beetle borer, sometimes known as the New Guinea sugarcane weevil. That's our quiz for today, and if you have one you would like to share about our backyard, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Thank you. Steve Turnbull is a sculptor who works with wood, stone, and bronze to emulate the shapes he loves in nature. He draws inspiration from the curvature of the driftwood he finds near his Maui home and spends hours giving the surface of his pieces the kind of inner glow that can only find in a lovingly tempered surface, be it wood or metal. He'll be talking about his work in Lahaina on Friday, and he joins us this morning from his studio. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
I'm interested that you describe your work as a collaboration with nature.
Yeah, nature is really a very important part of how my work evolves. Basically, my material tells me what to do. I'm following it, and it evolves as I create it.
So you might start with a piece of wood, and then do what?
Well, first of all, I'll look for a piece of wood that has something interesting in it. It might have a partial twist in it. It might have a big hole in the middle of it. So right from the start, it's got some interest to me. And then I clean it up. I start digging into it, and it's a process where I get surprises all along the way, and one thing leads to another.
This reminds me of a quote from Henry Moore where he said, "I cut away everything that isn't an elephant."
Exactly.
But that seems like a kind of a mystical process to the layman, yeah?
It's a process that it's so exciting to do because I don't know what's there until I'm there.
And yet the shapes of the works, I mean, you have very natural curvature in the works that I'm looking at. They look as if they could be a naturally evolved shape, yeah?
Yeah, the fluidity is very important. I feel that my job is to keep your eyes moving through the whole piece without coming to a stop. It's a never-ending S-curve, we call it.
Yeah, there's a piece I'm looking at. It's a bronze elephant, and it's not representationally an elephant, but it very clearly is with his head raised, and there's a lot of motion in that.
Yes, they're full of movement, and that's because of that never-ending flow. There's no dead ends.
So yeah, I can see that you have no you try to have work with no barriers in it, yeah.
Right.
Can that sort of in the creative process, can you sort of find yourself hitting a barrier? As you say, you're following the work and letting it tell you. Do you sometimes sort of hit a roadblock and have to figure out a way around it?
Yeah, and what I do when that happens is I walk away from it and I work on something else. If you came to my studio, you would see that I'm working on about 10 different pieces at the same time. I bounce back and forth, and sculpture needs downtime when you're creating it.
I would think so, but at the same time and I think that's good advice for other artists because everybody hits these roadblocks, right? Walk away, do something else.
And then for some reason you're going to walk by it one day and you're going to have a fresh look at it, and you can just get over that barrier in most cases.
Well, in a way you have to say, I mean, that's a voice of experience, but also of confidence in your technique that you're going to be able to, at a later date, address it, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely.
Have you started, most of the work that I'm looking at is wood or metal. Have you expanded into other materials lately?
Yeah, I carve marble as well. Marble, alabaster, granite, which is a whole different animal. Wood is kind of soft and forgiving, and stone is very cold and hard, and your tools bounce back at you when you're working on it.
Physically strenuous, I would think.
Very physically strenuous, and for that reason, I don't do as much stonework. But I do like to do it occasionally. There's a permanence to stone that I really like.
Can you get in when you're doing, say, a marble sculpture? Can you get in trouble when the material sort of cracks in the wrong place and maybe gives you a when you're carving? Can you get an unintended result sometimes?
Yes, that can be very disappointing with stone. And to solve that issue, you try to start with stone that is flawless or nearly flawless, and you can tell by tapping on it, the stone will ring if there's no flaws. If there's a flaw in it, it's going to stop that ring.
That's a good tip, because I have heard of sculptors working in stone who, you know, whack it one too many times and a big piece falls away.
Because you're hitting it pretty hard sometimes, and if that does happen, you're going to end up with two sculptures.
So you better have a plan B for that.
Right.
Well, that's a real commitment then, and working in stone. I would think that would be something that would only come with a lot of experience.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, what is there's a new work in onyx. What is that? Is that a particularly hard mineral?
Onyx is very similar to the hardness of marble.
Uh-huh.
It might be a little bit harder on the scale. The thing I do like about onyx is its translucency. The light tends to really shine through it when it gets thin, and it really can accentuate the shapes.
That's great. Because you also pay a lot of attention, especially the wood pieces. There's a lot of buffing on the surface to get that kind of almost a glow to the surface, yeah?
Yeah, and certain woods you can almost see right into the grain. The more you sand them, the more the grain comes out.
Yeah, no, a lot of time and patience, Steve, and I thank you for taking the time to talk with us. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Steve Turnbull is a sculptor who will be displaying his work and talking about it with visitors to Lahaina Galleries in Lahaina, Maui on Friday evening, and you can learn more at hpr2.org.
Well, that's going to do it for an abbreviated version of the conversation this morning. Abbreviated because, you know, we are in day one of Celebration 2014 closing time, and we hope that we will be able to button this up as quickly as possible and get back to regular programming.
Picking up momentum toward the finish line.
It feels like that this morning, and we can just hope that that continues. Just took a look at the big board, and we're just about ready to go under $160,000 to go. So if we can keep that up, who knows what might absolutely happen by the end of today. I'm so excited I can't get words out. But tomorrow, of course, we are going to be continuing on with the show. We're going to be having a conversation with CD1 candidate Mark Takai.
And we'll talk about a unique partnership between poet W.S. Merwin and the Hawaiian Islands Land Trust.
That's all coming up tomorrow. Right now, we're going over to Pledge Central and Ray Cruz.